The Pat Kenny Show
with Matter Private Network
on News Talk.
7 months into the conflict, Putin is back with a plan, reacting to a successful counteroffensive mounted by the Ukrainians. The votes on the annexation of Ukrainian territories and the mobilization of troops are two steps taken by the Kremlin in an attempt to reset the war. I'm joined by Andrew Roth, The Guardian's Moscow correspondent. We'll be joined also by Ukrainian MP Lesia Vasilenko and by Duncan Bullivan, Special Advisor to the head of the Bosnia Peacekeeping Mission, part of the UK mission to Kosovo in 1999, currently CEO of the Henderson Group. Good morning to you all. First, we're going to hear a few words from US Secretary of State Antony Blinken, who addressed the UN Security Council yesterday.
It must be asked, how has this aggression against Ukraine by President Putin improved the lives or prospects of a single Russian citizen? One man chose this war. One man can end it. Because if Russia stops fighting, the war ends. If Ukraine stops fighting, Ukraine ends. That's why we will continue to support Ukraine as it defends itself and strengthen its hand to achieve a diplomatic solution on just terms at a negotiating table. As President Zelensky has said repeatedly, diplomacy is the only way to end this war. But diplomacy cannot and must not be used as a cudgel to impose on Ukraine a settlement that cuts against the UN Charter or rewards Russia for violating it.
And that's Antony Blinken, the US Secretary of State, addressing the Security Council yesterday. We go to Moscow first and Andrew Roth. Andrew, the reaction to President Putin's speech during the week and the announcement of a partial mobilization, we always see it through the only lens we have, foreign journalists working in Moscow. What's happening domestically?
Yeah, I think that the takeaway that Russians took from that speech wasn't about the referendums, not even the threats about nuclear weapons. It really was all about mobilization. I think that's on the agenda right now. And, you know, for most Russians, I would say that they have tuned out the war, they've ignored it and tried to. And I think that mobilization is the moment when it comes home for a lot of them. This is the topic that everyone is discussing. A lot of men are trying to leave the country. People are angry. People are scared. We're seeing all kinds of scenes at draft centers across the country. This is a really important moment, I think, for Russia in this war.
Now, the question of 300,000 people being mobilized in the context of the population of Russia and the potential mobilization of all the people who've got military training, it may seem like the kind of number that Putin thought he might get away with without too much fuss.
Right. And we should be clear that we don't know actually exactly what the number will be. Shoigu, who's the Russian defense minister, said 300,000. But in the order, the actual number is classified. And based on my reporting, we're seeing people in their 50s being called to draft centers. We're seeing people with no military experience being called to draft centers. Summons being handed out at midnight. The number could be a lot higher than 300,000. And given that the Russians are not always very reliable with their numbers, I think it's possible they're going to draft more people.
Now, we saw the protests on the street after the speech was made being crushed fairly strongly and immediately by the Russians. That is a tactic, I presume, to discourage others from doing the same.
Right. And I mean, these are the kinds of sort of liberal protests in large cities that I think the government does not have that much trouble putting down, to be honest. I mean, these haven't really affected politics here for quite a while, although they do, of course, gain a lot of attention. I think the bigger issue is what's happening in villages, towns, cities across the country. Just seeing videos of local officials being confronted by angry families. These are people who are a lot poorer. These are people who have less to lose. And this is something that's a much bigger problem for the Kremlin than a protest in Moscow. I mean, this is something really, I think, that's going to be difficult at the local level in places across the country. And that's a lot of fires to put out.
Are people in Russia seeing funerals, for example?
Not too much. I mean, people do know about funerals have been, put on TV. There's an understanding that some people have died. The Russians have put out, I'd say, lower than honest numbers about the number of casualties that they've taken. But we haven't seen a kind of really strong backlash to the deaths of Russian soldiers in Ukraine. I mean, for a lot of people, they just view it as somebody else's I guess, somebody else's problem to a certain degree. You know, some people who have relative sons who've died in the war say that they support it still. And we don't see a really strong backlash against the war driven by those losses. It's something that's been compartmentalized so far. And it feels like the mobilization, to be honest, is a stronger shock to society than funerals.
Are they still calling it a special military operation in their reporting, or has it become a war?
People on the street at this point call it a war. It's a political choice. If you say special military operation, you're for the war. If you say war, generally you're against. But slowly the wall is being broken down. You know, we've seen Gennady Zyuganov, the head of the Russian Communist Party, basically say that, you know, this is a war and it should be fought like a war all out. So we've moved, I think, past the position where we're still calling it a special military operation. And I think we're transitioning to the idea that it is a war.
Now, much has been made of all the sanctions imposed by the West on Russia. For you living in Moscow, do you feel the effect of sanctions? Do you see the effects of sanctions?
You do in certain ways. I think that it hits middle class people the most. You see products disappearing from shelves that you can get abroad. Banking is more difficult. You know, your Apple phones might not work. You can't buy certain subscriptions. But to be honest, if you walk into an ordinary grocery store, you might not know that. You know, either for staple goods or for normal stuff. I mean, a lot of it you can still find here, and markets are kind of, you know, finding a way around the sanctions. One thing is that things have gotten a lot more expensive. I mean, just living here, I can tell you that I feel like prices have shot up 50 or 60% in the last year. And, you know, it's something that's notable, basically, that things have become much more expensive and life has become much more expensive.
I remember years ago when I went to Moscow when the wall had come down, and there were two economies. There was the dollar economy where you could get anything you wanted if you had dollars, and then the ruble economy. Is that beginning to develop again?
Not exactly. I mean, the ruble is very strong right now for various economic reasons. The main one is that Russia just isn't importing that much, so you don't need to sell rubles to buy dollars. The issue is more just the availability of things, and we have done reporting on parallel imports, which is how people are getting their Mercedes, their BMWs, and other stuff, you know, luxury goods from abroad, all to create this myth that nothing's happening, that nothing's wrong. You know, that was the way that Russia has lived for the last 7 months, is to pretend that nothing is happening at all. And that's kind of what's being shattered at the moment. So we don't see the kind of Soviet economy quite yet, but every day it feels like we're getting closer and closer.
And finally, I should ask you about people's access to information. I mean, to what extent is the internet working for people, social media, you know, because that's where all the bad news might circulate. Is that working?
So Facebook and Instagram and Twitter are all blocked. A lot of people use VPNs, which are still available. And, you know, there's Telegram, which is basically access to any information that you want. I always stress and feel like it's true that access to information is a political choice, and that people who want real information about the war are most likely against it. People who don't want that, who are choosing to watch state television or choosing, you know, patriotic, you know, pro-war Telegram channels, these are people who already have made a decision that they're for the war. I have seen very few people change their political opinions during this war in this country. People, wherever they stood on the 24th of February, is more or less where they stand right now. And I've only seen opinions harden among people. I haven't seen people change their minds.
Andrew, thank you very much for joining us. Andrew Roth, The Guardian's Moscow correspondent. Listening to that conversation is Duncan Bullivant. That's the scene actually in Moscow, Duncan. Looking at this from you know, a slightly broader perspective, what do you think is Putin's situation now, domestically, and we know he's isolated internationally?
Well, he's very much riding the tiger's back. He really, in many ways, has no option to other than to go forward with this madness, to be honest with you. I think within the international side of life, you know, the West, NATO allies and others are now mobilized and are up for the long haul. I think the political statements coming out of various meetings and various leaders over the last couple of weeks have given no indication of any crack in the NATO and wider Western resolve to end this conflict on the right terms rather than capitulation. Within the international community, I think also the other thing that has really happened in the last few months, which perhaps hasn't been that widely reported on, is that a lot of countries that were wavering, particularly in Africa, actually, wavering on the were leaning towards the side of Russia, have now firmly come back and said, no. You know, Ukraine is the victim here, and we can't support you in this endeavor. But I think most importantly, you know, this issue of mobilization, you know, this 300,000, and I think it's absolutely right. We don't know whether it's 300,000. I think what has effectively happened is they've now turned on the tap, and they'll draw down on manpower as they see fit. So it's going to be a never-ending supply of cannon fodder, effectively. These are not, you know, highly trained, fit individuals ready to go and fight a war. These are just warm bodies that are going to be fed into this meat grinder. And if you look at this from a tactical point of view, you know, Ukraine has built up its reserves of long-range artillery and rockets. Winter is coming. These guys, you know, mobilized reservists. Let's call it what it is. It's effectively mobilization of a conscript army. These guys are going to be sitting in trench systems and bunkers, and they're going to be hit time and time again by the Ukrainians over the next few months. The one thing that Putin cannot control, and the one thing that Putin has no influence over, is morale. And right now, you know, morale is on the side of the Ukrainians. They are increasingly better equipped. They are increasingly better trained, and they're fighting in defense of their homeland. So, you know, if you were thrown into the middle of this, command and control within the Russian army has been appalling from day one. Leadership has collapsed in many areas, and I think the weight of numbers may well mean that Russia gets to defend certain areas, and defense is very much the game once the rains come, and then the rains turn to snow and ice. But I think in international terms, Putin has now set himself up for a long-haul slog. The main victims of this now are going to be these so-called reservists, who I suspect, tragically, are going to be killed in vast numbers.
The question then is, when their families are sent home, the body bags for burial, what happens if you've got, you know, hundreds of thousands of these, and, you know, a good fraction of them coming back either maimed and incapable of normal living or in body bags? You can't keep the lid on that kind of thing. I mean, is there any precedent for a mobilization like this causing domestic trouble?
If you go back to some of the causal effects of the Bolshevik uprising in 1917, you know, Nicholas II, I mean, I think we all accept the fact that Putin sees himself more as a czar than as a president. You know, Nicholas II, you know, had kept a really tight lid on the population. You know, it's not dissimilar to the situation. I mean, obviously, you know, modern media and modern communications, you know, have played their part in population control and the spread of disinformation and misinformation. But I think, you know, what led to the Bolshevik uprising wasn't necessarily a reaction against suppression. It was the shame and humiliation that a nation felt when they were actually losing the war, and you know, the casualty rate was so high that they then looked back and they said that, you know, the corruption and the inefficiencies of the Tsarist state, you know, they reached a tipping point which led to popular uprising. Now look, you know, if it's 300,000 or 500,000 or 100,000. Yeah, that's 300,000 families. That's 300,000 individuals who are living a normal life. These are not volunteers. These are not part of the professional Russian army. And there comes a point in every society where, you know, people aren't coming home but are being killed, or they're being coming home and they're maimed. And this is going to bring the war closer and closer and closer to the people. Yes, probably in the villages and the smaller provincial towns and cities, perhaps not so much in Moscow. But there is going to come a tipping point, and I can't tell you when it is, but it will come, when the realization is that Russia is getting a hiding, and actually, you know, it's at the expense of their fathers, brothers, sons, and husbands. And I think this will have an effect in the medium to long term, but not in the short term.
Now, the narrative that Putin wanted to outline to the West was, we are going to have these referendums. Everybody knows they are going to be won by Russia. These territories will be annexed as part of Russia. If anyone dares attack Russia, then we will use tactical nuclear weapons to see them off. That's the narrative that he wants to frame. What do you make of that?
Well, I think, first of all, you know, you've got to, you know, answer the question directly. Is Putin likely to use tactical nuclear weapons? And I would put my money on the fact that he won't use tactical nuclear weapons, because it has been made very clear to him what the result of that would be. And it would not be more of the same. It would push Russia into a position where the Russian state itself was threatened. And I think those military commanders who would be responsible for delivering tactical nuclear weapons, you may well find that they would refuse to do so. I think with regard to, you know, the fake referenda, this tactic is now so hackneyed and so derided that, you know, perhaps in 2014. And you know, the Western reaction to Russian aggression in Crimea, Luhansk and Donetsk was pretty lukewarm, to be blunt, and it has created this stalemate over the last few years. But NATO's up for this challenge, and I think the difference now is that when Putin tries to legitimize his aggression through these fake referenda, and, you know, the outcome of which is already decided, and you know, there's no doubt which way it's going to go, is that it's such a puerile ploy that I think you'll find that the reaction to it will be pretty robust. You know, it isn't going to be recognized. It isn't going to be taken into consideration as a bargaining chip. And the idea that you suddenly make bits of Ukraine part of a sovereign state, namely Russia, and that's going to allow Russia to trigger, you know, the use of weapons of mass destruction. I think on this occasion, his bluff will be called and he'll be shown that he isn't in a position to respond to it. I hope I'm right.
Last question then is about the future for Putin. I mean, if he's taken out by the hardliners, perhaps war means war. If he's taken out by others who are lamenting the fact that a forward-looking Russia has turned its back on that direction. So what will happen to Putin?
Whether it's 30 days or 30 months, I think I think Putin's time is coming to an end. He has brought disaster upon Russia. And although the economy at this stage of the game is propped up largely by the fact that billions of dollars are still being pumped into the Russian economy through its exportation of gas and other minerals, I think the reality is that, you know, if you are a passionate nationalist and your motivation politically is for the greater glory of Russia, Putin's a liability now. So the only people that are going to keep Putin in power are those that stand to lose a lot if he goes. But my analysis of the situation and what I suspect will happen is there will be a tipping point where political opportunists will see a chance for them to grab power on the basis that Russia's, you know, standing in the world has been damaged. It needs to be restored and put back to where it perhaps was a few years ago, and that Putin is no longer part of that process.
Duncan Bullivant, thank you very much for joining us on the program today.
The Pat Kenny Show
with Matter Private Network.
Weekdays at 9 a.m. on News Talk.